Welcome to Norse Mythology, the unofficial guide. It's unofficial because I'm neither a credentialed academic nor a time-traveling medieval Norse pagan, but I deal with this material directly from the sources, interpreted through the lens of the experts and their opinions. If you're looking for depth and detail in a simple and accessible way, then you're in the right place.
Haft Solhun. Ligja und Hveralundi, lagjarns lik I loka othekjan, thar sitter sigun, thaugi of sinum, werwel glúðjúð, vitúð eren, eða hvat?
In the last episode, we talked about the death of Baldur, the events that took place at his funeral, and the failed attempt to get him released from hell. The short version of that story is that Baldur had been having nightmares about something bad happening to him. So the gods decided to get all living beings and inanimate materials to swear an oath that they would never harm him. This new invincibility he was given was upsetting to Loki, who then tricked Baldur's mother Frigg into revealing that there was a sprig of mistletoe who had been too young to swear the oath. Loki made some sort of weapon out of the mistletoe and took it to an assembly where all the gods were making a game out of hitting Baldur with different things and watching him remain unhurt. Loki approached Baldur's brother Hother, who was blind, and convinced him to shoot this mistletoe weapon at Baldur, which killed him immediately. A funeral was held, at which Baldur's wife Nanna also died from grief, and Thor kicked an annoying dwarf into the funeral pyre. Another of Baldur's brothers, Hermother, took Sleipnir and went on a ride into Hel's domain to see if he could negotiate Baldur's return. Hel agreed to let Baldur return if all living things and inanimate objects would agree to weep for his loss. Just about all of them did, and this is what we now call condensation, when water seems to appear out of nowhere on various objects when the heat changes. They are all weeping for Baldur. But there was one troll woman who refused to weep for him, and thus he remains confined to Hel to this day. And it is presumed, Snorri tells us, that this troll woman was Loki in disguise. What we didn't talk about last time were the consequences of Loki's actions, because it's around this point in time when the gods have finally had their fill of his behavior. His punishment is alluded to in the stanza I recited at the beginning of this episode, which is stanza 35 of Völuspá, quote, "A captive she saw lying under Cauldron Grove, an evil-loving figure, unmistakable as Loki. There sits Sigyn, getting very little joy from her husband. Do you want to know more? And what?" Notice that Loki is called here an evil-loving figure. There's an idea floating around that's probably at least based in some kind of reality about Loki only being made into an evil character by Snorri and by other Icelanders later after the conversion. So it's worth reiterating that this stanza comes from Völuspá, which is in the Poetic Edda, and although it does contain some possibly later material, it's typically believed to have originated in the 900s, which is right in the middle of the pagan era Viking Age. So let's dig into what this means a little bit. One big difference we see in the Prose Edda, which we traditionally attribute to Snorri Sturluson, when compared to earlier poetic sources, is that Snorri seems a lot more willing to apply the word evil sort of ambiguously to people when describing their character traits. Snorri tells us the very first primordial Jotun Ymir was evil, for example, with no further explanation. And as a precursor to the story about the binding of Fenrir, he tells us that Loki is evil in character. On the other hand, in older poetry, we usually get something a little more specific, describing the type of undesirable behavior that a character engages in. To be clear, Old Norse does contain words for good and evil that do form a binary pair, just like we have in English. However, the word evil, in particular, carries certain modern moral connotations that would not have been the same in Old Norse society. And, of course, evil is an English word given to us by translators. Sometimes, if we take a closer look at the original words used in the source texts, and apply some more direct translations, we can start to see things change in meaning a little bit. For instance, the word used to describe Ymir is actually illr, which is related to the English word ill, as in ill-gotten gains, or a person of ill repute. It's the same word Snorri uses when describing Loki's character, but it's also the same word that gets used throughout the sources when describing things like a hard loss, such as a death in the family. It's an ill loss. Or an undesirable fate, or even the difficult aspect of managing a strong-willed child. It can be used to describe reprehensible traits, but that isn't the word's only function. So whenever we see something called evil in a translation, we ought to look a little deeper and see what's behind it. In the case of the stanza I recited from Völuspá, where Larrington gave us the phrase evil-loving figure, the Old Norse word is actually lagjarn, which means more literally treachery-eager. So rather than ambiguously calling Loki evil, the poem is telling us exactly what Loki's problematic behavior is, which in this case is treachery, and very likely refers to the actions that the composer of Völuspá attributes to Loki being made into a captive, causing the death of Baldur. Other pagan era poets will sometimes use other terms as well. Þorstrapa refers to Loki as drjúgur at ljuga, which means pretty literally excessive at lying. My guess is it's safe to say that even though there may have been some continued demonization of Loki happening in Iceland after the conversion to Christianity, the notion that he was a problematic figure very likely seems to have begun at some point during the pagan era. But no matter how evil you consider Loki to be, both Eddas agree that he faced some pretty serious consequences following Baldur's death, consequences I'll call the binding of Loki. However, the idea that those consequences came immediately after this event isn't universal. I've mentioned the poem Lokasenna plenty of times on this show, and as it turns out, the dialogue we see in Lokasenna tells us that the feast taking place in that poem is meant to occur after Baldur's death, and the epilogue to Lokasenna tells us that Loki's binding occurs as a consequence of his behavior at that feast, rather than as a direct consequence of him orchestrating Baldur's murder. So let's consider for now that we can fit Lokasenna into the timeline and start there. As the story begins, Baldur's death has already occurred. Back in the poem Himmiskvida, Thor and Tyr had also previously retrieved an enormous cauldron from Tyr's father Hymir for the purpose of having feasts in the hall of a Jotun named Aegir. And exactly just such a feast is now beginning to get underway. One fun little Easter egg is that the very first sentence of this poem's prose introduction tells us that one of Aegir's alternate names is Gymir, which you may recall was the name given to the father of Gerðr, the Jotun girl with the shiniest arms that was coerced into marrying Freyr under threats of death and magic curses. So it would seem that at least someone in Old Norse society probably believed that these two characters, Aegir and Gymir, were one and the same. Now, as the feast begins, the guests are arriving. Odin and Frigg, Bragi and Idun, Tyr already one-handed at this point, Loki, Njörður, Skadi, Freya, and Freyr, who brings along two servants of his who are married to each other, and whose names are Bugvir and Bula. We also have Thor's wife Siv, although we are told Thor was absent, because as you might be able to guess by now, he was out in the east, which we have learned is where he goes to beat trolls or hunt Jotnar, or however you'd like to phrase it. As the author explains the situation, quote, many of the Æsir and elves were there, end quote. Whether or not any of these already named characters qualify as the elves in attendance, we aren't told. Some have theorized that there could be some overlap between elves and Vanir gods, given that Grimnismal tells us Freyr rules over Alfheimr. It could also be that the two characters mentioned in the very next sentence, Fimifang and Eldir, two servants of Aegir's who are supernaturally good at their jobs, are the ones who might be the elves. Fimifang and Eldir are able to use shining gold instead of fire to light the hall, and even cause ale to be passed around all by itself. When the guests see this, they begin to praise the excellent work done by these two servants. But Loki, we are told, can't bear to hear that, and he kills Fimifang, no specifics given. This enrages the other partygoers, who shake their shields and shriek at Loki and chase him off into the woods. But Loki doesn't stay away. He returns and has a short conversation with the servant he didn't kill, Eldir, about how he plans to go back inside and give everybody what for, and then just barges right back in. As Loki re-enters, the hall falls silent. Imagine those old Western movies where someone enters the noisy saloon who isn't supposed to be there, and then suddenly everyone just immediately goes silent and stares at him. Why is everyone so quiet? Loki asks facetiously with all the attention on him. Either give me a seat or tell me to leave. Bragi speaks up at this point and asserts that Loki will not be offered a seat, but Loki ignores him for the time being and turns his attention to Odin. Odin, my man, he says, do you remember back in the day when we made a blood brotherhood pact and you swore that you'd never have a drink of ale unless it was served to both of us? Odin, knowing this is true, and probably hoping to prevent the tense confrontation that this is becoming, turns to his son Vidar and asks him to give up his seat for Loki. Vidar does as his father asks and even pours Loki a drink. But before Loki puts the vessel to his mouth, he calls for a toast. "Hail the Æsir," he says, "and the Allsinir, all the most sacred gods. All except for that loser Bragi over there sitting on that bench." "Come on, man," Bragi replies in much fancier ancient poetic language. "Look, I'll give you a horse and a sword and a ring. Just don't ruin the feast." But Loki does decide to ruin the feast. We have a lot of material to cover, so I won't recount all of the dialogue exactly. But Loki begins throwing insults at everyone in attendance. He accuses Bragi of cowardice. He calls both Idhun and Gevjun promiscuous, claiming that Idhun hooked up with her brother's killer and that Gevjun slept with someone just because he gave her a jewel. He accuses Odin of granting victory to faint-hearted men in battle and of unmanly behavior, dressing up like a woman and spending time on Earth acting as a sorceress. He accuses Frigg of sleeping with both of Odin's brothers, Vili and Ve, and asserts that he is the reason why her son Baldur will not be coming back from Hel. He accuses Freya of being a witch and having slept with literally every man in the room, Æsir and elves alike, including her brother Freyr, and adds a cherry on top that when she was caught in the act, she farted. He accuses Njörður of being sent to the gods as a hostage, having a son with his own sister, and of allowing the daughters of Hymir to urinate into his mouth. He accuses Tyr of something really hard to understand that nobody seems to agree on how to translate, but that somehow translates back to the fact that he is missing a hand, and then claims to have fathered a son by Tyr's wife and refuses to pay any compensation for it. He accuses Freyr of being the cause of his own destruction by trading his sword for his now wife, and even tosses in an accusation of cowardice for Freyr's servant Bygvir. He accuses Heimdallr of having a gross, mucky back, which is somehow related to his job as being watchman for the gods. Larrington theorizes that maybe Heimdallr has to stand with his back to Yggdrasil, which Völuspá tells us is covered in a white mud. Anyway, Loki goes on to tell Skadi that he was one of the foremost members of the gang that killed her father Thjazi, and then finally claims that both she and Thor's wife Siv have been lovers of his in the past. Throughout the exchange, some of the gods return insult for insult. They threaten Loki with violence, remind him of the awful fate that will befall him in the future, and repeatedly accuse him of unmanly behavior and perversion, none of which seem to bother him in the slightest. But now, as Loki has just finished leveling his accusations against Siv, he has made the mistake of saying Thor's name out loud. And as we've started to piece together from our corpus of myths as a whole, sometimes invoking the name of a thing causes it to appear. This happens in the story where Loki wagers his head to some dwarfs and they end up sewing his mouth shut. In that case, a dwarf made an awl appear by invoking its name so that he could use it to pierce Loki's lips. And this instance appears to be similar to what happens in the story of Thor's duel with Hrungnir, where Hrungnir is sitting in the middle of Valhöll drinking all the ale and threatening everybody, and when the gods get tired of him, they simply invoke the name of Thor, which causes him to immediately appear and enter the hall with his hammer raised up. So just as Loki has spoken Thor's name, now Freyr's other servant Beula speaks up and notes that all the mountains are shaking, indicating that Thor is on his way home and will finally bring some peace to this gathering. Loki responds by calling Beula a dung-splattered dairymaid, and it takes Thor exactly that long to arrive in the hall ready to fight. Whereas most of the other characters in the story have engaged with Loki by tossing insults back and forth with him, Thor is not playing games. "You had better shut your mouth right now, you Argr little creature, or I will smash your head right off your neck," he threatens. "You won't be so daring when you fight against the wolf and he swallows Odin," Loki replies, remaining at first unfazed. "You had better shut your mouth right now, you Argr little creature, or I am going to throw you into Jotunheimr in the east, and no one will ever hear from you again." "Oh, don't bring up your journeys into the east," Loki replies. "Remember that time you hid cowering in the thumb of a giant's glove? You didn't seem so brave like Thor then." "You had better shut your mouth right now, you Argr little creature, or I am going to crush every bone in your body." "Come on, Thor," Loki says. "You couldn't even open the straps on Skrymir's food bag. Remember that?" You had better shut your mouth right now, you Augur little creature, or this hammer is going to send you straight to hell. Ugh, fine, Loki finally agrees. I'll leave. But only because, unlike everyone else in this room, I know you alone might actually back up your words. And just before leaving, Loki throws out one last curse upon everybody, claiming that they'll never prepare another feast. May flames burn up all their possessions, he says, and may their backs be burned in the process. At this point, the prose epilogue to Lokasenna and the prose Edda's story about the death of Baldur converge. And in fact, they don't contradict each other at all, except for on one very small detail, which leads us to believe Snorri may have used Lokasenna, at least in part, when crafting his own telling of the tale. In any case, his version contains more details, so let's now dig into that one. Loki escapes off into the wild and hides in a mountain where he builds himself a house. He knows that the Aesir will be looking for him to punish him, so he makes sure his house has four doors, allowing him to see out of it in all directions at all times. But he doesn't spend all of his time hiding in the house. The house is mostly just a nighttime shelter, and by day, Loki transforms himself into a salmon and hides in a waterfall called Franangr. Assuming that the Aesir might potentially figure out his hiding place, he starts wondering what sort of a device they might come up with that would allow them to catch a salmon in a waterfall. And as he sits in front of the fireplace experimenting with some linen thread, he eventually invents the very first fishing net, after which all fishing nets have been patterned ever since. Unfortunately, it's at this very moment when he looks out the door and sees that the gods are only a short distance away. Odin has apparently looked out into the world from his throne at Hlidskjalf and spied his secret hiding place. So Loki throws the net he's just invented into the fire and runs as fast as he can down into the river. When the gods arrive in Loki's house, the first person to enter is Kvasir. Now, we haven't talked about Kvasir for a while because he died in a story we went over way back in episode 8. If you'll recall, Kvasir was created from spit that was mixed together at the end of the Aesir-Vanir War. He was the wisest of all beings, but ended up getting murdered by a couple of serial killer dwarves who turned his blood into the mead of poetry. This story assumes Kvasir is still alive, though, so here he is. Kvasir enters and starts looking for clues as to Loki's whereabouts, and he notices there are some ashes laying in the fire in sort of a grid pattern. He realizes that this shape would work really well as a device for catching fish, and so the gods use the shape of the ashes to reverse engineer a new fishing net, which also apparently gives them a clue about where Loki must be, and they head on down into the river to find him. When they reach the waterfall, they throw the net into it. Thor holds one end all by himself, and the other gods hold on to the other end as they drag it through the water. Loki, who is now in the form of a salmon, sees what's going on, so he swims down low into this little area between two stones at the bottom of the river to try and hide. But the gods are able to see that there's something moving and alive down there, so they attach some weights to the net, ensuring that it will reach all the way to the bottom of the river and that nothing will be able to escape underneath it, and they toss it in a second time. Loki sees the net coming, and he knows that if he can just get around it somehow and into the waterfall, then it's only a short distance out to sea. So he jumps out of the water, like salmon do, and he glides over the net and then slips back down into the water just at the base of the waterfall. And he almost gets away, but Thor reaches out his hand and catches Loki by the tail just at the last moment. And this powerful grip upon Loki's tail becomes the reason why salmon are shaped such that they taper off closer to the tail. It's at this point that the Aesir take Loki to a cave to enact some poetic justice. It's also at this point Snorri might be making a little mistake in his narrative, as he mentions that two of Loki's sons, named Vali and either Nari or Narfi, are fetched. This is a fascinating little problem in that our sources seem to be kind of confused about where the name Vali actually belongs. Here, in Gylfaginning 50, where this story is told, Snorri explicitly calls Vali a son of Loki, and this is probably because he's repeating information he took from the prose epilogue to Lokasenna, which does the same thing. There's even a strange little stanza that seems out of place in the Hauksbok version of Völuspá that puts Vali into this part of the story as well. But if you read Larrington's translation of Lokasenna, you'll see that she has actually swapped out the name Vali for Nari. This is because there are actually more sources that name Vali as one of Odin's sons, not Loki's. And the idea that Loki has a son named Vali is widely believed to be a mistake. In fact, Snorri even contradicts himself on this point. In the Poetic Edda, Vali is described as the son of Odin, both in Baldur's Draumar, stanza 11, as well as in Völuspá and Skáma, stanzas 1 and 2. In the Prose Edda, he's described as Odin's son in Gylfaginning sections 30 and 35, and in Skaldskaparmál 12, and Skaldskaparmál 75, also called the Navnathulur. So to make things easy, we're going to go with the common theory on this one and say that Loki's two sons, who are fetched here, are actually Nari and Narvi, who Loki fathered with his wife Sigyn. One of these two sons is magically transformed by the gods into a wolf and made to tear out the guts of the other son. Lokasenna tells us Nari is the disemboweled one, whereas Snorri claims it was Narvi. We're not told whether the son who was turned into a wolf was ever able to transform back into his original form. Three stone slabs are then fetched, and the gods knock a hole through each one. They lay Loki across the slabs and bind him to them with his own son's entrails, which they thread through the holes in the rocks and then transform them into iron so that he can't get away. Skadi finds a poisonous snake and affixes it somehow to the ceiling of the cave such that it hangs over Loki and steadily drips poison down onto his face. And then the gods leave him there, with his loyal wife Sigyn choosing to stay behind by his side and to try and catch the poison in a bowl before it drops on his face. She does this because the poison is apparently agonizing to the touch. Whenever her bowl fills up, she has to empty it. And in these moments, poison is able to fall upon Loki's face, which causes him to writhe around so violently that this writhing has become the origin of earthquakes. And there he will remain until Ragnarok. A moment ago, I called this poetic justice. One interesting point that stands out to me in this story is that Loki has made himself responsible for the deaths of both Odin and Thor by fathering both a wolf and a serpent with the Jotun Angerboda. And it so happens, his ultimate punishment involves having one of his sons killed by a wolf and being forced to endure torment from a serpent for as long as the world lasts. It seems poetic to me in a sort of macabre way. Now, the story doesn't actually end here. You may recall that in the last episode, I mentioned that even though Loki is held responsible for Baldur's death, the fact that Hother was the one who actually fired the lethal shot means that he needs to face consequences as well in the Norse version of justice. This is where the name Vali re-enters the story, and why it's so important to distinguish whose son he actually is. In response to Baldur's death, Odin decides for some weird reason that he will need to sire a new son to avenge Baldur upon Hother. He fathers this new son with a woman named Rindr, and this is the person that all of these other sources call Vali. What's fascinating, though, is that all the sources I've mentioned so far only mention this piece of the story in passing. The most detailed version actually comes from Gesta Danorum, which is a euhemeristic history book by Danish author Saxo Grammaticus, and as I will never stop reminding you, euhemeristic in this case means largely fake history inspired by Norse mythology. But because the details don't show up in the Eddas, a lot of people have never heard this story. And since there are actually a couple of random poetic references that seem to confirm some of Saxo's highlights, it's probably as close as we're going to get to the original story, and definitely worth telling here. I should mention that this story does contain a brief description of sexual assault, so if that's a problem for you, I recommend stopping here. According to Saxo, Odin seeks counsel with seers and soothsayers about how he should obtain vengeance for Baldur's death, and he learns by prophecy how fate has been decreed. A woman named Rindr, who Snorri lumps in with the goddesses, but who Saxo calls Rinda and names her as a daughter of a Russian king, must bear Odin a son who is destined to kill Hother in reprisal for his brother's murder. So Odin dons a disguise and visits the Russian king, offering his services as a soldier. He ends up having tons of victories and becoming a general, which is how he slowly weasels his way into the king's inner circle. Finally, after one particularly amazing victory, he tells the king that he is in love with the princess Rindr, and presumably the king sees nothing wrong with this, so Odin makes an attempt at kissing her, but is rewarded with a slap across the face. Seeing that this strategy isn't going to work, Odin waits a full year and then returns in a new disguise. This time, he's pretending to be a skilled metal worker, and he gets in good with the king by his reputation of making beautiful sculptures out of precious metals. The king commissions him to make jewelry for the women around him, and Odin creates a particularly stunning set of rings and a bracelet that he gives to Rinder. But another attempt at a kiss results in another smack to the head. Saxo notes that Rinder clearly sees through this behavior, quote, a sly old fellow searching for an opening to exercise his lust by a pretense of generosity, end quote. She has a good sense that Odin's motives are not pure, and even though her father sharply chastises her for refusing a match with him, she is very young and finds the idea of hooking up with an old man kind of gross, and she's able to win this argument with her father by appealing to her own immaturity. So Odin opts for a third disguise, this time trying out the persona of a military veteran for some strange reason. Saxo notes that at one time, wizards were able to change their appearance more drastically than this, being able to resemble any age they wanted. But for whatever reason, Odin seems unable to make himself look young. He tries putting on an impressive show of military valor, goes in for another kiss, and gets shoved so hard by Rinder that he goes flying backwards and slams his chin against the floor. Understanding that traditional medieval seduction techniques are not going to work, he touches her with a piece of wood inscribed with spells, and she immediately goes mad. It sounds awfully similar to the taming wand inscribed with runes that Skirnir threatens to strike Gerther with in the story about Freyr's angsty love life. Odin now dons a fourth disguise, this time dressing like a woman, and taking on the role of what Saxo calls a female physician. The disguised name he uses is Wecha in Latin, and this whole thing is particularly reminiscent of the accusation Loki makes against Odin in Lokasenna, where he mentions that Odin once went among mankind for a time dressed like a seeress. Specifically, Loki accuses Odin of going around acting like a female seeress in, quote, Vitkaliki, meaning in the likeness of a Vitka. Vitka is a sort of confusing word that most scholars translate into something like wizard, but it's also pretty widely accepted based on a paper by Sophus Buga that the name Wecha that Saxo gives us for Odin is an adaptation of an old Danish form of the word Vitka. So it's very likely that this story is what Loki is referencing in his insult in Lokasenna. It provides a little more credibility to Saxo's account. Now, because Odin is in a disguise that makes him seem like he could help out with a princess who has inexplicably gone mad, he ends up in the royal inner circle once again. By chance, he finds himself assigned as Rinder's personal attendant, and this is where the creepiness factor really starts to escalate. Saxo tells us his job is to wash the dirt off of Rinder's feet at night, which allows him to start touching different parts of her legs, very clearly presented in the narrative as a big, creepy deal for Odin. One day Rinder gets sick, and as her personal medicine woman, Odin prescribes some medicine that he tells everyone is so bitter she's not going to be able to take it without being tied down to prevent her from violently thrashing around. The king agrees to let this happen. Odin is left alone with Rinder, and the result, of course, is the child that all of our stories up to this point have been calling Vali. Saxo names the child Boas, though, but I don't think we're entirely sure where that name comes from. To shorten a longer euhemeristic story, Odin returns home to Byzantium, where his actions are regarded as so disgusting and terrible that he is ousted from his kingship and made into an outlaw. But to be clear, Saxo explains that the thing that's gotten everybody upset is the fact that, quote, through actors' tricks and women's duties, he had brought the foulest of slurs upon their hallowed reputation, end quote. Saxo describes the other gods being upset about trickery and broken gender taboos, but he does not explicitly describe upset over what actually happened to Rinder. But after a decade, enough time has passed that Odin is able to get himself reinstated with a few bribes to the right people. It's at this point he notices that Boas, who our other sources call Vali, has developed a fondness for war, and he charges Boas slash Vali with the responsibility of taking vengeance on Baldur's assassins. However, now we're finally into some information that is comparable to our less euhemeristic sources. The poems Baldur's Draumar and Hundluljóð both agree that Vali ultimately slays Hother in vengeance for his brother Baldur, but Baldur's Draumar gives it a much more supernatural flavor. Quote, Rind will give birth to Vali in Western Halls. Odin's son will fight when one night old. He won't wash his hands nor comb his hair until he's brought to the pyre, Baldur's enemy. Reluctantly, I told you, Now I'll be silent," end quote. It's worth noting as well that Saxo's idea about Odin needing to use magic on Rinder to get what he wants seems to be corroborated by a short stanza by a poet named Kormákr that Snorri quotes in Skaldskaparmál. The line in question reads, "Seith Ygr til Rindar," meaning Ygr, which is an extremely common name for Odin that means terrifier, used Sather magic upon Rinder. And as you may recall from previous episodes, Sather magic is woman's magic, so there's a little extra circumstantial evidence there about Odin taking on a woman's role in order to accomplish this. But Cirrus's and magic and vengeance and broken gender taboos aside, Odin is still just going through the motions that fate has decreed for him. And soon, he will have to face his final, ever-encroaching fate as the doom of the gods unfolds, next time on Norse Mythology, The Unofficial Guide. Sources for this episode include Dictionary of Northern Mythology by Rudolf Zemek, 2007, Relative Saw and the Dating of Eddic and Skaldic Poetry by Christopher D. Sapp, 2019. Here I go, failing to pronounce Danish again. Studie over de nordiske Gude og Heltesagens Oprindelse by Sophus Buga, 1881. Gesta Danorum, translated by Karsten Friis Jensen and Peter Fischer, 2015. The Poetic Edda, translated by Caroline Larrington, 2014. And the Prose Edda, translated by Anthony Falks, 1995.